Welcome to the Broadcast Dialogue Podcast, the show all about the media industry in Canada.
Hi, I'm Stephen Ryan. I'm the CEO and founder of Ryan Media and Research Limited. I've been in the business since the 80s and have consulted with stations across the world. In fact, I think the total now is around 19 or 20 countries. And I'm best known as a consultant and research expert in the radio field.
Hi, this is Sean Smith. There's a next level player in the online audience music research space. It's Momentum Music Research, which is built on a cloud-based platform created by Stephen Ryan of Ryan Research and Media. It turns out that it's now possible to mount your own ongoing music research and see the results in real time and utilize a groundbreaking new algorithm that eliminates outlier bias to deliver more robust samples and a hit detective to help you identify winning songs and killer song rotations. Stephen joins us to talk Momentum Music Research, but also demystify the entire research process. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
No worries, Sean. Good to have a chance to catch up.
Now, you've got a storied background in media all over the world, and you're also known as an Irishman in the UK. How did you end up making the trip, the hop over to England?
Well, I was lucky enough to start working in radio when pirate radio in Ireland was doing pretty well. And that was back in the 80s because commercial radio didn't become legitimised until 1989 in the Republic of Ireland. And I had worked through various pirate stations as a newsreader and as a talent on air as well. And then Super Pirates came along. These were stations which were run basically as a professional radio station and had deals with advertising agencies and so on, were basically run as a legitimate concern. Just one small point is that they didn't have any licenses. So that was where I kind of got my grounding in radio. And then I started applying to radio stations in the UK and across Europe, some of the English language stations that might be in places like France and Spain and so on. And I got an opportunity to go and work in a radio station in France, which was broadcasting to the Channel Islands. And for those of you who may not know this, the Channel Islands is a protectorate of the UK. So it's part of the UK. And that was my first so-called legitimate job. The only small issue was that I thought it was legitimate because it had a license, but it had a license for 60 watts in a local station in northwestern France. And we were pumping out about 80,000 watts towards the Channel Islands. So we got away with that for a period of time. And then we had a visit one morning from a very annoyed man from Paris with a clipboard and about 15 armed gendarmes. And that was the end of that. So I then started looking at the other possibilities back in the UK. I got a job in the south of England in a radio station group called Ocean Sound. And I ended up being the morning show jock on one of those stations, then ended up being on drive time. So that kind of got me into the UK. And that's where I sort of remained ever since.
So you went from being a pirate, a renegade, into semi-legit, into totally legit, into on-air. So at what point did you make the shift into research? I mean, that's some pretty heavy suit and tie work right there.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't happen overnight. I worked as a presenter and a newsreader across a number of stations in the UK. And I ended up living where I live now in Cornwall in the southwest of England. And I was in management in the local radio station here and still doing some on-air work as well. And I was then given an opportunity to join the Daily Mail group. Now, the Daily Mail is one of the largest newspaper groups in the UK. And they had radio stations operating throughout the UK and also in places like Hungary and Sweden. And they had about 50 stations in Australia. So I was brought in under the guise of business development. And that's when I sort of got my first exposure to the use of research in radio, working with other companies such as Broadcast Programming and Research and so on from Australia. I worked there for a couple of years and then I joined another operation, which was an American operation, but based in Sweden, called Scandinavian Broadcast Services, or SBS. And SBS ran television and radio stations again across Europe. And this was anywhere from Scandinavia right down to Greece in the southern part of Europe. And again, these were stations that were run very much under the guise of, you know, researched and highly formatted and so on. And again, I was getting more and more experience. And then around 2003, there was an opportunity for me to look at some opportunities in Eastern Europe, where there was emerging markets. They weren't totally sophisticated, but they were beginning to be so. And I thought, well, I'll take some of this experience. And I started working with stations in Eastern Europe. And that sort of led on to other opportunities in Western Europe as well, back working in places like Greece. And I kind of developed the research side of my business during that period.
Now, what was happening in the business at that time and with technology in general around 2003 that would propel you into making research a really primary part of what you do?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there was obviously traditional research which was available to us, but the internet was still pretty young and we had sort of dial-up and so on, which wasn't very conducive to doing anything online. But the ability to be able to research music and select songs that, you know, were definitely going to be a hit with the audience was becoming more and more important. And when I say the emerging markets in Eastern Europe, you know, they were becoming sophisticated, but there was still an opportunity to make those products an awful lot better. And that's where the research came in. So it sort of developed from there. And then as online opportunities came about, it gave, you know, more of a scope to be able to do things maybe on a better budget and grow it from that point of view. So the research was always there, but not necessarily used in the best way. And we just brought it in and basically gave a station a more sophisticated edge in the market.
And at that time, we were, as a radio stations, we were competing against each other primarily. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there, as time went on, things became more and more competitive. And obviously, you know, we would go in and have first mover advantage and do really well. And then, you know, other people would become a bit more sophisticated. So you had to get smarter. But it was all about competition all the time.
What would a survey in the marketplace look like at that moment in 2003? What would you be doing?
Well, you know, there was usually a large heritage station, which may not have been that great, but it was the biggest player. And sometimes that was because it was a government-backed station and they sort of backed off on the commercial side. So they would have fairly, you know, large shares. I'll give you an example. When we went into work in Romania, when we went in there, there would be a large number of, you know, heritage stations, which may not be that good, but they were able to be successful because they had, you know, maybe big names. They had a bit of government backing and so on. And they'd have shares around the 17-20% mark. And we would go in and we, you know, we took on what was originally called Contact FM, and we rebranded that as Kiss FM. And within a very short period of time, we would then get around the 12-13% shares. And we had reduced that existing player down to around 5-6%. So, you know, there was competition, but it was competition in a kind of very light sense. And then we brought that sophistication in again. So it kind of changed the whole dynamics of the market.
And this was sort of the beginning of online music testing and offering a way for your P1s to interact with you and tell you about the songs that you're playing.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we started off with the, you know, traditional field work through a third party, you know, to get AMTs done and also for call out on an ongoing basis. But as time went on, the internet, you know, the broadband facilities got better in each of these countries. We could start to look at the more online side of things. And I started to develop mainly analysis tools that were online so that I could be sent information very quickly, I could process it, and then they could see it really quickly. And that's kind of where the sort of first steps into online research as we know it today from my point of view.
Now, I understand that you were able to create your own cloud-based platform to service some of your needs because it just wasn't available, right?
Correct, yeah. You know, as time went on, you know, using Excel to do data processing is fine to a point, but it is a bit laborious. And there was an opportunity to be able to, number one, you know, look at the analysis side of it and then put a front end to that so that actually the field work all the way through to the analysis could all be done using the same platform. And that was something we were able to develop over time, but using the expertise we'd seen through, you know, the use of traditional call out done through field work with a third party contractor or indeed AMTs. And therefore, you know, as the internet got better, we got better and our tools became more sophisticated.
And lots of other companies followed with various offers for the industry. Fast forward to 2021 now. And talk to me about the need for really robust research in the marketplace right now, where we are faced with competition from streaming providers or from everywhere.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there was an evolution that was taking place anyway. But because of the pandemic that we've all suffered under, it's kind of fast-paced everything and got things moving an awful lot quicker than may have been expected initially. And the analogy I would use is a bit like, you know, online shopping. It's been there for many years, but it's been growing gradually. Suddenly we have a situation whereby people have to go online. And they're now wondering why they never did it that way in the first place. Mm-hmm. The sort of same thing when we look at online research. You know, people are used to doing things in a particular way. But there's two ways the pandemic has caused an effect here. One is that, for instance, you know, doing a traditional auditorium test and inviting, you know, 150 people into a room to sit together and very mm-hmm. closely together and to be in a room to listen to songs for a couple of hours really isn't going to be possible. If ever, it might never come back. But even if it does, and, you know, hotels and venues are allowed to host these again, there is a problem that people may be just too nervous to do it. And also then we have the situation whereby there's a lot of listening going on. So, you know, in general, across all the markets that I work in, you know, the time spent listening has gone up. The overall listening has either plateaued or gone down slightly, but the actual hours listened has gone up. Therefore, things like rotations and so on are going to be noticed. So if you've got very hot rotations and people are listening far longer than they did before, you know, possibly, you know, 15 to 20% more listening time, you really have to be very, very careful that every song you're playing is thoroughly thought through and is the right song to be playing at any time. Because as you rightly say, it's not just radio that's providing the competition now. It's also the online services and the streaming services. Mm-hmm. So you have to be absolutely sure of everything you put on air.
Right. So those sort of recurrents and you know, older songs that you might be playing that you think, hey, look, that tested really, really great 2 years ago. And I know nobody else is playing it in the market. It's got to be doing great. When in fact, that song may be burning just by the very nature of it being out in the universe, off platform, burning the listeners out. And you don't know that.
Exactly. And if you don't have some way of being able to judge that, then you have a problem. Because, you know, if you're running a load of burnt songs, people are going to get tired. And we know what happens when they get tired. They go somewhere else.
Now, you've evolved your cloud-based platform to a next level kind of status by evolving and developing the algorithm that does a couple of things. It identifies hits and then it tells you what to do with them. Can you get in behind that a little bit and tell us why the algorithm makes a superior data set?
Well, you know, traditionally, you know, when you have things like call out and it's done in the traditional methodology, so you're making a call out to somebody who's guiding, you know, the respondent through the process, you have control. You also, if you're conducting an AMT, you're in an auditorium, you're able to view the people, you're able to look them in the eye, you can see exactly what they're doing, are they paying attention and so on. Again, you get control. Once you go online, there's a kind of a fear factor that maybe you don't have so much control, you don't know who's coming in, and you don't know whether somebody is the right candidate, even though they claim they're a 15 to 24-year-old female.
Right.
How do you know? Uh-huh. Well, this is why we developed the algorithm. It's that at the end of the day, in any sample, even in the traditional call-out and AMT methodology, you're going to find outliers, people who just behave well outside the norm. Now, that may just be because they happen to like your station, but actually they're a really big fan of your morning show, but they're not overly keen on the music, but kind of put up with it. Therefore, they might be downrating the songs, but they're behaving in terms of, you know, someone who would be your P1 music listener, the person who absolutely loves what you do. They're going to start diluting the power of those songs. Or you might just get somebody who's just having a very happy day and going crazy on the other end and over-emphasizing how they loved all the songs. So how do you eradicate that? Well, that's where the algorithm we've developed comes in. It looks at the data. It looks at anybody who's behaving well outside the norm. And that's based on a number of things. It's how they score the songs, the sequence, how they score the songs, and the time they've taken to make decisions and so on. And by using this algorithm, it brings back that sort of necessary feeling of control. You know you're going to get a more robust sample. Because if you don't have a robust sample, then from, you know, survey to survey, if you're doing call-out, it could be bouncing all over the place and you wouldn't know what to do. But this gives a much more smooth trending to the system.
Have you ever suspected that there were competitors out there that were trying to monkey about with your sample?
Well, I'm not going to mention any names, but people have actually told me they do. So, now, I mean, it's usually just somebody because, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, if you know, unless you're recruiting secretly behind the scenes, you know, you're publicly saying we want people to come in and help you to play the songs. And no doubt somebody down the road might just think, well, I'll go and help them play the songs and give them a completely wrong steer. But this is, you know, that's the joy of an algorithm, is it'll suddenly go, hang on, this person is just not behaving in a normal fashion, and they can be removed from the sample.
So how does the sample change? Does it change fundamentally when you take out some of these outliers, some of these people that are not completing the surveys in a uniform way?
Well, it depends on what the outliers were doing. I mean, you could have a mix of outliers who were, you know, overrating the songs and some underrating the songs. So you mightn't see a huge difference. But generally speaking, you'll see them as a group that are either overcompensating or undercompensating. So you will see a difference in the numbers. So certain songs you'll see that, you know, the score that you started out with the full sample will go up compared to what was before. Also, you've got to, you know, be aware that if somebody's being malicious, then it's going to be well outside the norm. And what you want to do is just make sure that you take out the unusual behavior and then you analyze what you've got as regards the result of that with what you had originally. And then you begin to see a very clear picture of what those outliers were doing. So, you know, in terms of composition, you don't want to see a huge change. You don't want to see that you're testing 15 to 34 and all the 15 to 19s have disappeared. You'd like to see that the outlier removal had taken out a proportional amount across the entire demo you're looking at. And you don't want to see that suddenly all the males have disappeared and you only had the females if you were doing both. So there's, you know, our system looks at that and makes sure that, you know, the balance of the remaining sample once those outliers are taken out remains the same.
So what happens if you're not real happy with what you have left over? Is it kosher to be able to go out and ask more people to come in to the survey?
Absolutely. You know, you can either, you know, at the end of the day, you can start again from scratch. But, you know, the way we work the system is that you're building a panel first. So you're not recruiting, you know, onto a full survey on a completely raw and open basis. You recruit your panel. You now have, you can see the composition of your panel. You can then invite people per a composition that you'd like to achieve. You can then monitor the process as the survey takes place. And, you know, you could send out a perfectly balanced number of people to be invited to the survey. But as the survey is going on, you can easily spot, hang on a second, maybe there's not as many 20 to 24s as I'd like. So you could send out a few more invites to that particular demographic, and then you get your balance back in.
So there's no need to be worried at this point, because presumably you have far more P1s that are attached to your radio station that are participating online as your friends than you would say on a 50-person call-out survey.
Yeah, it comes down to numbers, Sean. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, you can own, you know, the more granular you want to be, the bigger the sample you need. And the difficulty is, you know, if you've got samples as small as 50, if you're on a very narrow demographic, that might be fine. But the problem is, if there's an issue with that, what you want to be able to do is be able to increase the respondents or to, you know, include more people in the survey. And that, you know, if you're doing that through traditional methods, that's going to cost you extra money. Whereas this is something that gives you more control on a much more cost efficient basis, because those people, or you have them already, and you can just add in people as you need without thinking, I've got to ring the fieldwork company and how much are they going to charge me per person? You know, it's a completely different thing to consider, and it's much more cost effective.
So you end up with a list of songs in front of you with some scores attached. I understand there's a hit detective involved here. Can you walk us through how that works?
Well, this was something that was feedback from clients, basically, because, you know, there are lots of people out there who have a lot of experience in working with, you know, music and research and so on. There are people who are not quite so sophisticated with it. So they'd say, look, I can see all the big songs and I can see all the lower songs. And those lower songs are either not scoring well because they're unfamiliar, because they're brand new, or they're on their way out. But what about all these songs in the middle, you know, which are kind of have a similar score? What should I do? And that's where the Hit Detective came in. It is an algorithm, but it's an add-on to the main Outlier algorithm. And basically what it does is it looks at all the individual metrics, you know, the burn score, the negative score, and so on, and compares that, and then gives you the ideal list order of what songs you should be playing. So, you know, you might say, I know exactly what I want to put into my powers. I know what I want to do into my tertiary rotations, but those ones in the middle, which ones did I put? The Hit Detective would help you by simply saying, this is the best order. If you need six songs and we're showing you 10, you take the top six, and they're the ones that should go into the medium rotation.
So there's so much more than meets the eye, is what you're saying. The what's known collectively as the algorithm will be able to spot this data behind the songs and give you a much better idea of where to put them.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like having, you know, dare I say it, a consultant on your shoulder or, you know, an advisory there, where that, you know, you are making a decision based on the best information you can have. Now, you know, as a music research expert or a person who's a music director and has a lot of experience, they will still want to look at the individual metrics and make that, you know, that balanced judgment. But, you know, they'll always, everybody likes to have a reassuring tap on the back saying, yeah, I like the way you made that decision, and that's the right decision. And even in those scenarios, the Hit Detective can give you that clap on the back.
Well, let's face it, Stephen, at this point, with folks who've been in the industry for a long time and previously would have the time in their week or in their day to play with the subtleties that we're talking about, the time isn't there now. So if you can have a consultant sitting on your shoulder, basically looking at numbers you can't even see with the naked eye, and you can save yourself some time, I think even the most experienced practitioner would say, you know, I'm down for that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the one thing that we also emphasize is that, you know, in a lot of traditional methodologies, you have to wait until the survey concludes before you can make decisions. With our system, it's dynamically updating all the time as the survey continues and as the sample grows. And so long as you have decent samples, you're beginning to see, you know, the highlights and potentially some of the issues as well. You know, if you suddenly see burn scores going to 35 to 40, you might think, I'm not going to wait until the end of the survey. I'm going to change something now. Again, once, you know, you want to do the overall analysis, yes, it can be speeded up using the system. And when you do have time, you can go back and revisit it and have a look. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, the way the industry seems to be going, it's reliant on less people doing an awful lot more. And because they're multitasking, they would like to be able to spend, you know, a long period of time making every decision. But this is a system that will actually go and go, look, if you want to make the right decision, this is the way to go, because the algorithm will help you get there.
Now, the system we're talking about is Momentum Music Research, powered by the iRate Cloud Platform. Now, Stephen, we've got you here. And while you're here, I want to just take your temperature. You're looking out at the universe of radio right now in 2021, coming into, dare I say, post-pandemic. What do you see? What forecast, or can you see at all? What's the near future for the radio business?
It's difficult, Sean, because, you know, the near future, things can change. The pandemic may last an awful lot longer than we thought, you know, even with vaccines around. But, you know, looking forward, you know, we are, as an industry, seeing, as I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot more time spent listening. People may be slightly diverted away from that, but it's still important that, you know, they're getting, you know, every time they tune in, they're getting what they need, and it's not being given it to them on a consistent basis. So I don't think things like that will change. Radio has, you know, proven itself in other ways through, you know, being an information source and even more importantly, a reliable and trusted source. So I think that the radio industry will have benefited from that. You know, we will see continuing competition from the likes of the streaming services and so on. But I don't think, you know, I don't think we'll see the death of radio anytime soon. It just needs to maybe adapt and move and maybe, you know, look at the internet and the streaming side of things to look at how you might be able to bring out, you know, secondary stations with a slightly different music focus and so on. But, I think for the foreseeable future, radio has a shining light on it.
Fascinating discussion, my friend. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy week to have a little talk about the intricacies of research and the importance of it in the music radio business today. Thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you, Sean. Take care.
That's Stephen Ryan of Momentum Music Research, joining us from the seaside in England. For more information, visit MomentumMusicResearch.com.
Thanks for listening to Broadcast Dialogue. For more information about the podcast or to receive exclusive access to our weekly briefing about the Canadian media industry, visit us at broadcastdialogue.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, connect with us on LinkedIn, and follow us on Twitter and SoundCloud.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.